It's the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 5515, Department of Higher Education. And I'm going to turn it over to Legislative Caucus Steve Bender. And Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members. What we sort of have planned for your work session today is to wrap up the discussion of the chart that we were going through yesterday, where we had almost come to the end, and finish that up. It shouldn't take too long to get through the remaining items that are in that particular chart, and then move on to a discussion of other fund revenues in the budget, and look at performance measures and the impacts of these funding packages on performance measures. As you know, one of the requested items in your work session, one of the things you were asked to do is to review and approve performance measures of the department, and we hope to be able to go through the discussion of performance measures and complete that today. There is, of course, again, a work session scheduled on this budget for tomorrow as well. This, we did call your offices and left a message with all of them, asking them to make sure that your budget binders were here with you today. You can leave those here today after the meeting if you'd like. We know they're rather large to lug around. And the specific reason we asked you to bring them again, we know you've been carrying them down here and then often not ever looking at them, but we've got, I think a lot of the questions you might have, answers will be in either of these two binders, so it will be helpful to have these available to you. But if there aren't any questions before we start, may I ask you to go back and look at the item that we distributed to you yesterday. This was the recommendation dated May 29, 2007. And it was the document that on the back of the first page included a table that listed the LFO recommendations for the general fund and lottery fund portions of the higher ed budget. And we had gone through row 22 and had a somewhat extensive discussion about investment income. Some of this may still be a little unclear as to what this package is doing or what denial of this package is doing. We can go into that further now or come back to that at a time when you'll be asked to take a vote on this particular package.
Actually, excuse me, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I had to step outside and I heard the words investment income. Did you explain what investment income was, Mr. Bender, when I was out of the room?
No, I did not.
Mr. Chair, could I have him explain just exactly what that phrase means?
Please.
Absolutely.
The Oregon University system deals with a lot of money, both general fund and lottery fund dollars, such as you see here on this page, plus, in addition, large amounts of other funds, which includes tuition, student fees, and all other sources of monies that have become available to the department. These monies are held in the state treasury, and as with all funds in the state treasury, they are invested in typically in short-term instruments, and the interest earnings on these accounts then become, under current law, a revenue source to the general fund. The monies that are the earnings on the funds that are attributable to higher ed's portion of all of the funds that are held in various accounts in the Treasury from all state agencies, at least for the operating portion of the budget, are estimated to be $16 million in the upcoming biennium. So this is what we are really talking about. We're talking about the various cash balances that higher ed would hold in accounts that are earning essentially interest. To think of it more as money in a checking account or a savings account is not inaccurate in the sense that the treasurer then invests these funds and investment income is generated from these. Again, the projection is that at least for the funds that would be affected by the proposal to change the use of investment income or the disposition of the investment income, that would total $16 million. There are already some funds that higher ed holds to which the investment income is not deposited into the general fund. For example, to the extent that higher ed receives donations for capital projects that are going to be matched by Article 11G bonds, typically there are provisions that allow higher ed to retain those investment earnings for those particular donation purposes. But what the proposal under package 451 is to end the practice of having the investment earnings on these monies accrue to the general fund and instead to allow higher ed to retain those earnings.
Senator Morse.
Mr. Chair, thank you. What would be the opportunity cost if we keep the model as proposed?
I do not have an estimate of the opportunity costs in the current biennium of keeping, of not adopting the model as proposed. That is to say, as proposed, the projection is that there would be $16 million of investment income that instead of accruing to the general fund would be retained by higher ed, and that higher ed would then be given authority to spend these funds in lieu of an equal amount of investment income that would go on to the general fund.
The opportunity cost of a follow-up refers to the increased earnings by better cash management.
If I could defer to either the department or to DAS on this issue, I believe that the $16 million figure already accounts for any increase that would accrue from better cash management. I don't know if that's correct or not. That's my understanding, that this is supposed to be revenue neutral. I do know, however, that if it is the case that under improved cash management, higher ed is able to earn more than $16 million in the 07-09 biennium, we're not talking about future biennium, but in 07-09, the biennium that you're budgeting for, they are not given authority under package 451 to spend any more than $16 million of these earnings. So if they were to be able to earn $20 million, they could not spend more than $16 million of the earnings this biennium.
Representative Morgan.
Go ahead, Steve.
Can I just say one thing about better cash management while we wait for Steve to...
For Senator Deckard.
Drink. The funds are in the Treasurer's short-term account, and so that is why better cash management, that is the encumbered nature of those funds. Is I think we see the positive effects of the Oregon Investment Council in terms of funds that are not in that short-term account, but it is the short-term account that limits the Treasury's ability and the OIC's ability to actually maximize returns. And so that kind of gets at the heart of why the interest earnings are not where we're used to seeing that type of double-digit or percentage increases from the OIC.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Morgan.
Yeah, we had a discussion yesterday in committee about the potential to have this quantified, to do a study on it, and I was wondering if there was a discussion with the co-chairs on where they were willing to go on that kind of thing. I honestly don't know how much has been done in terms of scoping what the potential is here and what the risks are and all those kinds of things. But I do think that if there is the potential to realize more money off those investments and still keep it within a risk range that we would find acceptable, that it would be something that we would want to explore and work with.
Can we elaborate on this?
There's somebody who can come up, please. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Jay Ketman, Vice Chancellor of Finance of the Oregon University System, and this is the legislative concept contained in House Bill 2198, which would, as Mr. Bender said, allow us to retain investment earnings. We believe that, and we have had a study actually done by the Common Fund, and we've worked with experts out of Harvard University to look at our cash balances and look at our cash needs over time. And the basic benefit, there's three basic benefits from this bill, in my opinion. First, we would work with Treasury to invest our funds differently and stratify our cash balances into short-term needs, intermediate-term needs, and longer-term needs, and invest those longer and intermediate-term funds in higher-returning investment instruments. Typically, you know, T-notes and other things. If you go out over a longer time period, the short-term investment pool with state treasuries, I understand, averages 120-day maturity. Some go out 2 to 3 years, but the average is 120 days. We'd probably stretch that average a little bit in keeping some of that deep core cash invested in longer-term instruments that would, again, return higher investment yields. Secondly, we believe that having the incentive to earn money on idle cash balances would make us more efficient in managing our cash flows, scrutinizing both inflows and trying to expedite those inflows, as well as scrutinizing outflows in terms of cash disbursements. Today, many of our departments just get a bill and they pay it when they get it. They don't hold it because there's no incentive to us to hold it, and they have many other pressing things they've got to do. So we have done a lot in this regard already. I'm saying to get to the next level, we probably need more incentive. We have put in a lockbox payment processing system. We put in a procurement card program that allows us to get longer float or longer lead times on bill payments, etc. The third benefit from this is actually a companion bill, in my opinion, to House Bill 2199, which would allow us to issue variable rate and synthetic fixed rate debt. And when you do that, especially if it's purely variable, there's certain risk on the upside that the interest rates will go up in the short term and you'll have to pay higher debt service, but that would be offset by higher interest earnings if we're able to retain interest earned on our cash balances, so it mitigates some of that risk. You can also mitigate that risk by using synthetic fixed rate instruments that have swaps where you swap a variable rate bond into a fixed rate bond. And the credit for that idea belongs to Laura Lockwood McCall in State Treasury, who we've been working closely with on both of these bills, actually.
Representative Morgan.
So, Mr. Kenton, what bottom line is the potential here for revenue generation?
Well, as Mr. Bender correctly noted at the beginning, part of our funds today, we receive the investment earnings on. Part of them, the investment earnings accrue to the general fund of the state. When we look at the total pool, and I'm forgetting off the top of my head exactly what the breakdown between the new funds that accrue to the general fund and the funds we currently hold, but we believe that by managing these funds differently, based on the current investment market, that we could grow that. It's $19 million in total. 3.1 is off in the capital budget, 16 is in the operating. So it's 19.1 total today. And that's based on actual cash flows from 05-06 and actual investment returns in 05-06. We believe we could grow that to around $35 million just by changing the investment strata. And, you know, then if you are able to expedite your cash inflows and slow down your cash outflows, you could probably grow it beyond that. That's a very rough estimate, but it has been documented in a study that has been performed for us by the Common Fund.
Thank you. Do you want to follow up, or Senator Devin?
Could the study be made available to the committee? And two, I just had a very basic question, not using exactly your terminology, but similar, which you have short-range, intermediate, and long-range investments. And they're all in now the short-term account with the Treasurer's Office. Wouldn't the configuration of neither, the bill is not before us, would those intermediate and long-term investments still be managed by the Treasurer? or would they be managed by the system?
Mr. Chair, Senator DeDevlin, it would still be managed by Treasury. And, you know, they would be our investment manager. We would work with them to stratify these things in a way that, in fact, we've had meetings with Treasury, and they believe they could do that for us.
So I hate to say it this way. So hypothetically, if we changed how those funds were managed and we didn't give you any of the interest, we could earn more interest on the money that we have for the general fund. That's what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that is correct, although I would note that, you know, I cited three benefits. The second benefit, which is having the incentives accrue to the department, I think would better manage cash flows. And I have to tell you, I came into the state in 1983, and I managed cash for a major industry in Oregon before I did that. And over the years, I asked about cash flow management, and I was always told, oh, don't worry about that. It doesn't matter here. Well, it does matter. And it matters significantly, and I think putting the incentives in the right place can really do a lot to change behaviors as well as to maximize the upside of these opportunities.
Mr. Chairman. I clearly understand your sentiments about incentives and sort of clearly understand that if the incentives aren't to the people that are actually day-to-day managing the transactions or the departments responsible for them, that's where the incentives actually need to be.
There's a significant amount of money on the table here that would be available for whatever the legislature decides that it should be available for. Clearly, it would be an easy nexus into the higher ed budget. But I think that we would be very remiss to just pass this opportunity by. And I recognize that at this late date in the session, with leadership being where they are and clearly having a pathway to bring this thing down for a landing, that it may not be possible at this point in time to take this on. But I think that clearly this is an issue that we should be putting our arms around in the interim with an eye to the spring session. Or this is just too good of an idea to pass up. I think that it's silly of us to walk away from this opportunity to manage our cash better and make a significant increase in our ability to buy services.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with all of the things that Representative Morgan said, except the one that suggests we can't do it now. The Treasury has pursued the new tools to allow them to manage the increased risks of instruments that have higher interest rates. Those have been passed through the Revenue Committee, and I believe they're either in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, or they've been passed through the process. I'm not certain at this point. This bill that isn't on the floor before us, but which we're in fact talking about, has come from the Revenue Committee, and in my opinion, at least, should be ready to work. I don't think we have to wait. I think we can do it now.
Works for me.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
I always wanted to chair the Revenue Committee, so this has been fun. I appreciate it.
Don't worry, Senator.
So thank you for providing that incentive or that information there.
Incentive, that's good. Go in slip there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Morgan.
I hate to just kind of drop this with, this sounds doable. And I'm wondering if it would be possible to approach leadership with the potential that we have here.
The chair doesn't plan to drop this. I think this has been a useful discussion, so I will certainly take it to the co-chairs and talk to leadership.
Well, we have the chair of the Senate Revenue Committee, the chair of the House Revenue Committee on this committee also.
I know we're quite fortunate.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, we've made it abundantly clear that we see the merit in, I don't know what the bill number is, 2198. I think we're fighting for it. I think we are.
Steve? Just a couple points to assist you in your deliberations here. I did want to note that the narrative description of this report is in the governor's recommended budget on pages 424 and 425, if you want to look at that either now or later. Another consideration as you pursue this issue is to note that, of course, higher ed is not the only state agency that has fund balances. Your fund balance is held by almost all state agencies, and this, if the policy of eliminating the interest on these fund balances from general fund and allowing the state agency that holds the balance to retain these earnings is an appropriate policy, you may want to consider that for other agencies as well.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is one of the arguments, of course, against making this change. And I don't want it to be understood that, but I believe that we ought to make the wholesale change that the last remark might suggest. I think we need to move very cautiously and carefully. I think that the department is an exception to what we probably would consider to be the normal rule, because such a very large percentage of the funds available to the department are what we call other funds from fees. And that most of the money we're talking about investing actually comes from things like tuition, class fees, other fees, room and board charges, and things of that sort. That makes it very different, I think, in some ways at least, from other agencies. If in no other way, just in terms of the sheer magnitude of the sheer size of the dollars that are involved, I'm certainly not suggesting that we should make a wholesale policy change. This is a pragmatic issue, and we ought to think of it that way.
Thank you, Representative Morgan.
Well, and not to beat a live horse here, but I think that this is also a kind of a pea under the walnut shell discussion, because we're famous in this building. If we find one revenue source, it's a great excuse to back general fund out and put it somewhere else. So this is essentially a zero-sum game we're talking about here.
Representative Barnhart.
Three words. I hope not.
Thank you. Steve,
I'm going to go back to the
programs and next row on the table.
Okay.
The sports action lottery. We started to talk about this a bit yesterday at the end of the meeting, but I think that conversation was a bit abbreviated because of time, and I just want to clarify what Row 23 actually indicates. Row 23 in the governor's budget includes $2,659,165 in increased funding over the essential budget level for the Sports Action Lottery Program. The Sports Action Lottery Program is a program that provides funding, dedicated funds, to higher ed to support intercollegiate athletics and graduate scholarship programs. This dedicated source of funding under prior to the 2005 legislative session was the Sports Action Lottery Games, which were two games that the Lottery Commission ran that involved wagering on the outcomes of football games. The legislature in 2005 eliminated these games effective with the 07-09 biennium, thereby eliminating the source of revenue, but replaced it with 1% of net lottery proceeds. The 1% of net lottery proceeds will generate more money than the old funding source did, and this particular package, Package 090, is a package to allow the increased funding over the essential budget level to not only be received, but to actually be spent. The net amount of $2,659,000 represented a difference between the increase in funding and an offsetting general fund reduction. And the increase in funding was projected to be approximately $7.5 million above the essential budget level in terms of sports action lottery funds. What the governor's recommended budget does is it allows the $7.5 million in additional lottery funds to be spent, but it also reduces general fund by $4.9 million, leaving a net increase of approximately $3.4 million in funding. The offset amount reflects the amount of general fund that is estimated to be used to support intercollegiate athletic programs in the existing budget. So the governor suggested that the new lottery funds be used to offset and to finance subsidies of intercollegiate athletic programs that had been supported by general fund. The co-chair's budget continues this policy. The only change is that the revenue amount is reduced by approximately $800,000 to correct for a change in the lottery forecast from the time that the governor submitted his proposal, and also to correct and note that there will be 7 quarters of distributions in the 07-09 biennium and not the 8 that had been assumed. Beginning in 09-11, there will be 8 quarters of distribution, but because of the change in the law, there's actually only 7 distributions this biennium. So the impact of the reduction will be to set lottery expenditure, the lottery fund increase, to $6,761,000, which would be equal to the expected level of revenue. Finally, the last item here is package 401, which is a package in the budget called capital construction. This is not the proposal for capital construction that was in the governor's budget in terms of facilities that are financed. It's a very small portion of this package. It's the part that relates to the operating budget. Indeed, it's the part that relates to debt service adjustments. The governor's budget included about $8.5 million in lottery funds for debt service that has to be paid in the 05-07 biennium for new projects that are being proposed. I'm sorry, for the 07-09 biennium, for new projects that are being proposed for the 07-09 biennium. The co-chairs reduced the amount of new projects that they are willing to support in their budget that have 07-09 debt service costs. So this reduction of $2.6 million leaves $5.85 million for this purpose. And we can have more discussions about this now or when you go look at the capital construction bill later. But this would fully fund debt service for lottery bonds for new projects that would be due in the 07-09 biennium. Thank you.
So we're going to shift over to...
I would, Mr. Chair, like to talk briefly about other funds, if that's of interest to the subcommittee.
Yes, that would be useful.
And I would refer you to this sheet, which has some colored columns in it. It's a one-page sheet with a lot of numbers on it. And I just want to talk about some of these other funds. These are not all of the other funds. First of all, they are limited other funds. And these are only the other funds that go into the education in general program. This just gives you some idea of the monies that OUS is projected to receive in 07-09 and where they're coming from. Up and through row 23, you're looking at tuition revenues. The three colored columns represent the current fiscal year that we're in, and then the yellow and the green represent the two fiscal years for the 07-09 biennium. And the column on the right, which isn't shaded in, is the sum of the yellow and the green columns. Basically, you can see that if you look at row 23, we're projecting that OUS will generate approximately $1 billion in gross tuition revenues from students who are enrolled, both during the regular academic term and in summer session and continuing education. I just would like to point out that to some extent, if you're wondering, for example, what the impact of approving the shared responsibility model would have on these figures, the way that it works is that these numbers represent the total amount that's being received for tuition, and to the extent that a student receives an opportunity grant that would help pay for part of this cost, that doesn't affect these numbers. It just means that the full $1 billion would not be coming from the students or their families' pockets necessarily. The state and other sources of scholarships would be supporting some of these payments, but these are the amount of dollars that are received from the various sources for tuition charges. If you look at rows 25 through 30, this refers to resource fees, and there has been some discussion of resource fees both in this committee and outside of this committee this session. The resource fees are expected to generate, I'm looking at row 29 in column J, approximately $85 million above the tuition level. And if you look at row 30, this is projected to be 8.6% of the total tuition. Resource fees would be an additional 8.6% of revenues over the amount of what is billed directly as tuition. The 8.6% represents the same ratio that we have in the current biennium. There was a limitation that was approved in the last budget that said that the resource fees shall not exceed 8.6% of gross tuition revenue, and the projections are that they will continue to not exceed that. These are the projections that higher ed has submitted. I would also note that if you look at the red row, which is row 33, you'll see a number that is net tuition and fees. So what this represents is the following. It represents the gross tuition you see in row 23 plus the $85 million that you see for the resource fees, which we're broadly calling education fees, minus row 49, which is the fee remissions. Fee remissions are tuition deductions that the institutions award to students based on various criteria. These fee remissions turns out to be approximately the same amount in total as the education fees. They're not directly related, but the totals turn out to pretty much offset each other. So if you look at row 33, you can see that the projected net revenues after the fee remissions are awarded from tuition and fees rounds off to almost exactly $1 billion. You can't get much closer to $1 billion than that. So we're talking $1 billion of tuition and fees. Then below that, you can see there's about $190 million from other sources. The largest of these other sources are indirect cost recoveries, which are funds from federal grants that are allowed to be, that the institutions retain for general operating purposes related to administration of these grants. And these are the numbers here that you can see. Before we go on, I'd just like to point a couple things out. If you look at columns D and G, you'll see they're both labeled percent increase. What this indicates are the percent increases in tuition rates on average that are being assumed for each of the various categories. So if you look at row 8, what the number is saying in column D is that on average, the budget would support tuition rate increases for resident undergraduate students of 3.4%. This would be a weighted average. Some students would have increases of more than 3.4%. Some students would have less. Since this material was provided by OUS, LFO has learned that there is an intention of the board to allow the resident undergraduate instruction amounts to increase actually by more than 3.4% on average to accommodate a proposal that's being implemented by Western Oregon University to implement a guaranteed tuition rate. We just got those numbers a couple hours ago and have not had time to incorporate these into the table, but we'll attempt to do so before
clarification. That would be an adjustment in the tuition at Western Oregon, right?
Correct.
Right, okay.
And it would bring the total, on average, above the 3.4%.
Okay. Just the impact on the one institution trying this sort of novel way to...
Yes. This, Mr. Chair, this seems like the forever stamp. You know, you buy it today and you never have to pay more for it later. So is that what this is about? A guaranteed tuition rate at Western Oregon? You buy it today?
And not forever, I don't think.
Probably not forever.
If you attend the years consecutively, not if you come back 30 years later, I don't think.
4 years.
Four-year guarantee.
That's another little theory. Let me ask here, because I'm seeing 3.4, given that my son is about ready to become a graduate student at the University of Oregon, I see that the resident grad instruction fee is going to go up 4% instead of 3.4%.
Yes.
How come they get to increase their fees to 4% over the 3.4?
This would be the proposal under the governor's budget.
Wow. So I have something to say about that. Okay. One would think. Okay, I see there's quite a few of these, Mr. Chair. They're at 4%, which is a chunk of change. Let me ask again also about, let me ask about the resource fees. As some of you may know, we had a bill in the policy committee and we resolved that short of a bill in terms of the board is going to work with the students and develop some policies around resource fees. But when I talked to one of the presidents of one of the regionals, they don't have any resource fees. They just have a matriculation fee. So could we talk a little bit about the how that is unbalanced in the system, in the university system? How some universities, such as my own, University of Oregon, have a bountiful of resource fees and others don't, and they use that to supplement their what they pay for at their universities. So is it unbalanced in the system? Do some of the regionals make it up in other ways, or do some of the major universities get a lot more money because of the resource fees?
Can you answer that question?
I would attempt to answer some aspects of your question. I don't think I'm going to be able to answer all of the provide all the information you're requesting. I would like to state that the resource fees that you see listed in there comprise broadly two categories of resource fees. There are resource fees that all enrolled students have to pay, or essentially all enrolled students have to pay. And then there are an additional resource fees that are program specific that some institutions levy and that some do not. My understanding of the bill that you had considered was that it referred specifically to the subset of resource fees that were program specific. The resource fees that are not program specific but that are across the board are, I believe, levied on at all institutions. Is that correct? Or are there some institutions that do not have those types of resource fees? I know this. I can't. It's escaping me right now.
Those are what are called matriculation fees. Or is that different?
This is different. A matriculation fee would be paid essentially one time when you first enrolled at the institution. The resource fees would be a mandatory enrollment fee that would be added to tuition.
But not all universities, Mr. Shore, do impose programmatic resource fees. And I think some do it more than others to a shameful degree, actually, if you look at the amount of money they raise from students. I'd like a little more information about that practice from each university. Actually, I would. I would like to see how much each university raises from its students in the matter of programmatic resource fees.
Okay, maybe we can get
and
some.
I'm sure the board has that information because they've been studying hard to avoid a bill coming out of my committee.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Senator Devlin. I just wanted to get a clarification on a couple of things. One of them is, obviously, I think on the increase in tuition, our discussion of this last biennium, which was very extensive between the co-chairs and the committee, was primarily focused on undergraduate tuition.
Yes.
Not focused on graduate tuition. It's a different discussion. And I think that's where the governor's been focused. But I have to ask the obvious thing in this spreadsheet, and that is, resource fees are obviously in some sense supposed to pay for a service or a program utilized. It's related to that. But there is a difference between 8% per year, which if you did 8% per year, that would be 18% per year. If you did 17% the first year, it would still average out to the 8% or less. But in a sense, you would be collecting a lot more that first year, obviously, than if you'd put 8 and 8. And is there a reason why the board has chosen to collect so much of the increase in the first year?
I do not know that reason. But I do think this may be an estimate as opposed to these reflecting particular actions on the part of the state board. I would, Mr. Chair members, like to comment on the relation of these fees to Senate Bill 5515, which is the bill, of course, which you are working on today. Senate Bill 5515 does not in itself limit or address tuition rate levels. Under law, the State Board of Higher Education has authority to approve all of the tuition rates that you see here and fee rates. In addition, they approve a large number of rates that you do not see here because there are rates, for example, for housing or dining that aren't included in this list and are not considered other funds' limited revenues. The impact that this legislation, this bill, has on tuition is this bill will include an other funds expenditure limitation, which will limit the amount of revenues that may be spent in the 07-09 biennium from these sources. In the past, there have been budget notes that have been approved that essentially indicate what the expectation is for tuition rate increases, or indeed even limits them in a sense that says we expect that the tuition rate increases will not exceed this level. However, budget notes do not have the force of law, and the State Board of Higher Education retains the right to approve any tuition rate increase that it wishes to, but of course is well aware of the legislative intent to the extent that it is expressed in the budget report or as a budget note. But I did want to clarify that this bill that you are working on cannot legally limit the tuition rate increases, but what you do is you set an expenditure limitation to the extent that if tuition rate increases are approved that are greater than that, there would not be legal authority to spend those additional funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see the line here for energy surcharge. I complained about this last session, and I'm still complaining about it. I would like, Mr. Bender, a list of all the OUS institutions who still have an energy surcharge, and I want an explanation as to why they're still doing it. I can tell you that the University of Oregon better not be charging one, because if they get any of their power supply from EWEB, Eugene Modern Electric Board, they had a rate decrease for their customers. So I want to know why this is still being charged upon students. And it's a charge they get every term when they pay their fees.
Chairman, may I answer that question?
Yeah, how do you know the answer?
Well, if you look at the Oregon University System 2006 fact book, Comparing Driving in Higher Education in the United States, you will find that Oregon has led the nation in disinvestment in higher education to the tune of 41.4% from 1991 to 2005, which explains why we have such high
fee and tuition increases.
Which does relate directly to the bill that we're that we're talking about here. So we can indirectly influence this.
Right.
So.
Well, not really. I appreciate the effort here, but I do want to know what these nickel and dime fees, particularly the energy surcharge. I mean, I understood that when it was implemented. There was a period of time a couple years back where when you stayed at a hotel, actually, they would implement an energy surcharge on the hotel fee. That lasted about 3 or 4 months till people finally got pissy about it, to put it bluntly. But, you know, the students don't have anything to say about it, and I want to know what the justification is for the continued surcharge. It looks like it raises quite a bit of money, $2 million, $2.2 million over the biennium, which is, you know, a chunk of change. But if it's not necessary, then raise it somewhere else and don't call it an energy surcharge when you don't need it.
Thank you, Senator.
Mm-hmm.
So are we going to... Did you have any more on the other funds? Or are we going
just to close out, to comment, if you're interested in just how sensitive these funds are to the assumptions, if the tuition rate increase, for example, for resident undergraduates was 1% per year above or below what is being projected, the impact is about $6 million over the biennium. That same would be the case if the growth in the number of students was 1% or above, each year above or below projected. That would be an impact of $6 million. If it were the case for all tuition rates, as opposed to just resident undergraduates, each 1% has an impact of about $14 million in revenues during the biennium.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
I hate to bring back this subject. It hasn't been brought up. This fee remissions. On the fee remissions, my understanding is fee remissions are used for a multitude of different purposes. Sometimes it's to attract students basically on the basis of academic excellence. Sometimes it's on the basis of need. Sometimes it's on the basis of need and academic excellence in the same student. If we fully implement the quality education model, will there be as much fee remissions being used?
The shared responsibility.
Shared responsibility model. Almost slipped there. Shared responsibility model. Will there be as much fee remissions being used for undergraduate students because of need? It's a hypothetical question, actually.
I think that's it. You don't need an immediate answer.
No, no, just a theoretical.
The chances they're going back and forth.
But it would seem to me, at least, that there must be some relationship between the two.
Because I do think those are used for a variety of reasons. It's not just about finance. You know, it's.
It's a whole
diversity,
lot.
Yeah. So, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had a related question. Given that the shared responsibility model makes the explicit promise that students who work a minimum wage job over the summer and for a limited duration during the school year can afford either a 2- or 4-year institution, I'm curious how sensitive the projected number of students under the shared responsibility model is to the projections listed here on this sheet. If, for instance, the average undergrad tuition increase is going to be higher than what's indicated here, does that necessarily mean that we need to make an adjustment on the shared responsibility model in terms of the forecasted number of students who can be covered, or ultimately the amount of the grants that would be awarded?
The initial estimates of the impact of the shared responsibility model on student enrollments were that there would not be, and I don't have the number here, so this is being somewhat judgmental, a very large increase in the number of students who would attend as a result of the implementation of the model, though clearly there would be some additional students. And this would have an effect, therefore, on the revenues that were imposed. My understanding is that these particular enrollment growth proposals have not made any projected adjustments specifically for the implementation of the shared responsibility model in the second year of the biennium.
Thank you, Representative.
All right.
I'm waiting for a question on the Department of Education or OHSU. No. What's, are we going to go to performance measures?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry that I spent this
these are important items
because the performance measure is a very important item, too, as well. And I would, we received information today from higher ed that talks about the impact of performance of some of the funding packages that they're requesting, and that responds to some of the questions that the committee had yesterday. So with your indulgence, I think we can start with that and perhaps ask if there's anyone from the department who would be willing to help us work through some of these materials that they've provided, which are being distributed right now. We may be able to start going through them and just call on them as questions arise.
Is there someone from the department who can help us go through the handouts, the supplemental impact statements, and policy packages?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Weeks, Vice Chancellor for Strategic Programs and Planning. And I may beg your indulgence, as you have questions, to call on other people who may be better able to answer some of the questions on the specific packages.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, do you want to go through the supplemental impact statements? I think that this is an item that talks about the impact on performance of several of the packages that are being requested in this budget.
And then following that, we would then go over the, or then just not even talk about the performance measures.
I think it's time permits, we should start talking about some of the performance measures.
To just lead off with this.
Because this, I do think, does respond specifically to some questions which were asked yesterday, and that therefore this would be very topical to talk about. Maybe I'll just begin. If you look on Package 111, Regional University Support, package in the governor's budget is to provide $9 million in support specifically for the smaller campuses of the system. And what this particular measure is showing is that there are now two institutions that are not projected to maintain a fund balance equal to at least 5% of their operating budget in the current fiscal year. The 5% is the minimum target established by the State Board of Higher Education for prudent financial management of fund balances. Under the governor's recommended budget, the expectation is that both of these institutions will be able to maintain or restore at least a 5% fund balance after the biennium is over. So there would be continue to be two institutions in this situation in 07-08 and only one in 08-09, and then afterwards the institution should be able to maintain at least a 5% ending fund balance. The level there that's for co-chairs, it must be for the original co-chair's budget where there was no funding for this particular package. Of course, now the co-chair budget is equivalent to the governor's recommended budget. But if we chose not to approve the $9 million in the co-chair's budget for regional university support, the projection is that the two institutions, I don't know if they're the same institutions or not, but that there would continue to be two institutions next biennium that would be unable to maintain the minimum fund balance reserve established by the board, and that this indeed may deteriorate further next biennium.
I had a question. How does this compare with, say, 10 years ago or
Can you contextualize this or a bit?
I don't know. I can't contextualize this. I know that this is a more recently established board policy. The policy does not go back 10 years, and we probably could check to see what the situation was 10 years ago, but it was not a policy of the board at that time.
Representative Barnard. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that if you want to take a look at this item, you go back 14 years before Measure 5 was fully implemented. That way you can get a sense of the stress on the institutions from the current and recent reductions in the OUS budget.
Thank you.
I would also like to point out the last sentence in the narrative on Package 111, that OUS is indicating that not only would two of the institutions have fund balances of less than 5%, but that two would have the potential to entirely deplete the fund balance, that is to say to bring it down to zero during the upcoming biennium without this fund. The next package that's indicated here is there were questions about the statewide public services funding, and I got this handout only about an hour before this meeting, so I really haven't had time to go through this entirely, and I think I will need to ask Ms. Weeks or someone else in the audience for some additional background on the statewide public services and whether these targets relate to the amount in the governor's budget or in the co-chair's budget, since there is a difference there between the two, unlike in Package 111, which we just went through.
Mr. Chair, I would ask that invite one of our statewide public services folks to respond to that, if I may.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the record, I'm Thane Dotson. I'm director of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Station at Oregon State University, one of the statewide public services. The information provided talks about the policy package that was submitted by the Board of Higher Ed to the governor, and then the governor's recommended budget level, and then the co-chair's, current co-chair's budget level at $3 million. And the impacts on the agricultural experiment station, for example, in addition to research grants brought in by additional faculty members, there is a calculated amount of state dollars in the economy that are generated through our research and extension activities. And I did a calculation based on our Oregon Invest database that each additional FTE that we have, or calculated each FTE we have, generates about $2 million annually within the state budget. Half of that, $1 million, is direct economic dollars in the economy. The other half is the multiplier effect, and our economists say that the multiplier effect is between 1.5 and 2.5, so I use the middle of 2. So there's $1 million per FTE generated in the economy of direct dollars, and then another $1 million of those dollars rolling over in the economy with the multiplier effect. And so what I did is indicated the number of FTE that we would have in each of those budget scenarios, and then calculated the amount of dollars that would come into the economy as a result of that. And then on top of that, with the other Forest Research Lab and the Extension Service, there is also additional dollars generated by are those two agencies in addition to the other productivity measures.
Thank you very much. That was very useful and helpful. Thank you very much. Continuing on, package 202, which is a package we haven't discussed yet, but is a package in the governor's budget that would extend the sunset of the forest harvest tax. The forest products harvest tax is a funding source, one of the funding sources for the College of Forestry and the Forest Research Lab. This tax sunsets every 2 years, and there's typically a bill, which there is this session as well, to extend that sunset. Package 202 allows expenditures of funds that would be generated from the extension of that tax, and this would cover the salary of 27 faculty and staff, approximately 27% of the faculty of the College of Forestry and the Forest Research Lab. So this particular funding source is very critical to the current operations of the College of Forestry. The reason why you have not seen this package in any of the lists I distributed yet is because this is in other funds revenue. The Forest Products Harvest Tax is just not going to the general fund, and so far we've only been talking about the general fund affected packages. Package 302 is the ETEC funding, and again, I did not have time to review exactly what was submitted before the meeting today, so I don't know if these target impacts that we're talking about reflect the governor's level at $17 million or the co-chair's level at $10 million. I know the committee was interested in knowing what the differential impacts would be of choosing one of those funding levels compared to the other.
Mr. Chair, let me clarify a little bit on page 4 of that handout. If you look at the bottom, the targets displayed there, the numbers displayed there, are based on our agency targets, which were set with respect to the guideline to be ambitious but realistic. And those are not; they do not necessarily reflect the co-chairs. The targets that would be set in reflection of the proposed co-chair's budget. If you see the target rationale, longer range effects text at the bottom of that page, there's a little bit of explanation there that indicates that the impact of reduced funding in the co-chair's budget would be approximately 50 degrees by the year 2009, primarily master's degrees, with cumulative effects in the future biennium, resulting in a cumulative effect of approximately 150 degrees by the year 2013, and that would obviously delay the goal of doubling the number of degrees within 5 years, or by about 5 years, excuse me.
Thank you. Of course, the difference between the two funding levels is $7 million, so I believe that is $70,000 per degree.
Representative Barner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're on this topic, I know it appears as though there was actually a decline in the number of degrees conferred from the high point of 2004 to about 100 less in 2006. Have I read that correctly?
You're correct. To some extent, some of the decline has been primarily in the area. We record here both computer science and engineering degrees, and some of that's been the computer science field where there's been a softening, not so much in the engineering.
And you expect to catch up going forward?
That is the projection. That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Please proceed. The last page of the handout that you're going through, it's in package 351, the Institute for Natural Resources.
This is an interesting issue here as you look at this, in that this indicates that the 2005 Legislative Assembly approved $250,000 to cover costs of the Institute for Natural Resources in last biennium. The agency then applied these for the second year of the biennium. There was no specific direction, though, with the appropriation to do that. There's no indication that the appropriation of the $250,000 in funding was to be to provide funding for 1 year only. At the level that the program is being funded, the costs double this biennium to $500,000. The governor's recommended budget, by adding another $250,000 to the base, would approve funding of a full $500,000. The co-chair's budget at this point, which has a $50,000 reduction from that, would therefore, although it is a supplemental funding above the essential budget level, would represent a requirement for the Institute for Natural Resources to reduce its budget from the level at which it's been operating. I don't know if that was clear or not, but it's sort of a situation where the money that was provided was...
unprovided.
The money that was provided for the biennium was allocated on an annual basis, and that therefore the roll-up at that level of funding is to double the amount of cost the next biennium. There was no particular instructions, though, that this funding be considered one-year funding as opposed to two-year funding when it was provided 2 years ago.
Can I ask a question, Mr.
You're
Chair?
Welcome.
Thank you.
I the director to come up
here. Actually, did some research on the Institute for Natural Resources last year. I was looking up something and came across their webpage, and they have an incredible array of talent and research that they provide for the state. Can you tell me, and I don't recall from my research, when we created this in 2001, no funding was provided, but was there ever discussion, Mr. Bernard, I know you've been around that long, was there ever any discussion that there was an intent by the legislature to fund this institute, or was it always just left open to private funding or an expectation that unless you would pay for it?
I don't recall back from 2001 what the discussion was. I do know that in 2005, the governor's budget included $250,000 of general fund for the institute, and the Legislative Assembly did approve that recommendation. I believe that was the first time that there was a specific general fund added specifically for this institute, but there may be others here who can confirm or deny that.
Yeah, perhaps the director, Director Ackerman, he wouldn't mind coming up and clarifying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker. I was not here in 2001. I was in the state but was not actively involved.
Ms. Ackerman?
Gail Ackerman, Director of the Institute for Natural Resources. So I was not directly involved in the legislation. Dr. Dean Salwasser was, and he might want to correct me, and Representative Morgan was very deeply involved at that time. The story that I have been told is at the time that it was created as part of the Sustainability Act in 2001, there was discussion about how it would be very nice to fund it, but the state was in a very deep fiscal crisis at the time, and there was no funding available. And so Dr. Rister, the president of Oregon State University, and Representative Morgan and others who advocated for the creation of the institute said, set it up, we'll see what we can do. And that's really how it got started. And then I worked as the first full-time director to come to the 2005 legislature to seek legislative funding for the core operations of the institute.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Just to expand on Gail's conversation here, this is an entity that pretty much makes its own way through the world. Very little of the operations of the agency are covered by this appropriation or any of the appropriations that it's received. It's primarily funded on a contract basis for the work that it does. So it writes a contract with an entity to do a certain study or do something like that. But there are core functions of the agency that have become really important to policy discussions that we have here in the building. And I think that if you take a look at what that $50,000 was going to buy us in terms of just different ways to think about the way that we operate state government and make it work more efficiently and try to find that place in the definition of sustainability where you honor the environmental considerations, you honor the social considerations, and you honor the economic considerations, and you find the place where those three circles intersect and look for policy in that place. That's the very broadly and very basically the mission of the Natural Resource Institute, and that the experience that I've had, and I currently serve on the board of it, is that they have done some extraordinary work in kind of redefining the box that we think in as we try to move into this sustainable way of doing things in the state of Oregon. And I strongly advocate for this $50,000. I think that this is a drop in the funding bucket that we're looking at, but that the kind of work that's being done that can be brought to this body to be used in consideration of policy discussions is very worthwhile. The agency prides itself on being a science-based organization, kind of separating the wheat from the chaff in terms of the information that it brings forward, or being very straightforward about what the quality of the information is. And this is something that we really need in this policy arena. This is something that agencies really need as they work forward with policies and try to look at the ramifications and try to look at the best direction to move it in. I think that the state of Oregon gets a great bargain from this.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ackerman, to what extent would the reduction of $50,000 in funding affect the outcomes-based environmental effectiveness evaluation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I gave you a list of three. I mean, if I didn't get the $50,000, that's sort of the core support that allows these new initiatives to get started up, and I'd probably have to eliminate, I think, a research assistant, and I'd have to pick one of these three. I think one of them would have to fall off the plate. Frankly, that is an area where we have just received a significant grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. We're doing a nationwide evaluation of the effectiveness of one of EPA's major programs, the five-star program. So I think that we're far enough along on that one, and the potential and the demand is so high that that one would probably be less likely to be cut than the environmental services one, where at this point we don't have any funding, although we've got a lot of people that are potentially interested. And that's what the research assistants do working with me, is they have the conversations with the Defenders of Wildlife, the Willamette Marketplace, which is the Willamette Partnership, to talk about how can we work together. And you've got to be able to pay for the time to have the conversations before you can apply for the grant. And so it's one of these three. It's less likely to be about outcomes-based evaluation simply because there's a huge national demand for that, and we've been told by others that we're uniquely well-positioned to. Others think we're uniquely well-positioned to perform that research.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Moving forward, we're almost done with these handouts. This is exciting.
Yes. Package 352 is a package to provide general fund support for the Oregon Solutions Program.
And as you can see, there is a measure here of the number of community-based projects that could be completed with funding. The funding level that's indicated is the $1.5 million that was in the governor's budget. The amount in the co-chair's budget is somewhat less at $1.2 million. We don't have a specific measure for that level. Note that the funding, at least at the $1.5 million, is a significant expansion in the program's activities, which would increase the number of community-based projects from 15 this biennium to 53 next biennium. I'm not sure exactly what the $1.2 million would do, but I don't know if there's anyone who can comment further on that or whether this is sufficient information for the subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bender, isn't this program administered through Portland State University?
That is correct.
That's what I thought. So, you know, there is precedence here that we have our institutions of higher learning administering programs such as the Institute of Natural Resources, such as Oregon Community Solutions. So, we're giving them a bunch of money, and I think we need to be paying attention to this INR as well.
Thank you, Senator Walker.
Finally, Mr. Chair, members, there were two additional handouts that have been distributed to you today from higher ed. One is labeled Package 112, which talks about the recruitment and retention of faculty and the impact of that funding. The other refers to the impact of the Vet Diagnostic Laboratory. I don't know if we have time to go into detail on these today. It may be helpful with Ms. Weeks here today. I'm not sure if she'll be able to return tomorrow. If she could talk briefly about Package 112.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to do that. As you know from the testimony I provided a month ago about our approach to performance measurement, we have a few targeted measures that we provide that are related to outcomes and to high-level outcomes. But in addition, we also do maintain a body of data that we monitor, we look at, we don't report as and target as performance measures, but we do feel are important in helping us gauge the outcomes of the things for which we secure funding or seek funding. And in this case, in the package related to recruiting and retaining faculty, there are some additional measures that I thought might be of use to you to understand that we do look at and consider and that are important to monitor, although we do not set targets for them. And these fall into two categories. One is the measures that are related to our ability to attract and retain faculty. And the other are measures that are a consequence, really are focused on the outcomes of the institution's success or failure in recruiting and retaining faculty. In the first category, we look, of course, at our average salaries compared to our peers, because faculty look at average salaries compared to peers. We operate in a nationwide market. And the other is student-faculty ratios. And this is actually both, it falls into both categories because the student-faculty ratios are something faculty consider as a workload measure in whether or not they decide to accept an offer or decline it. And we've actually had institutions who have indicated that in some of their searches, faculty will decline an offer because of those kinds of considerations. The measures that are a consequence of the institution's success or failure in recruiting and retaining would be, for example, the percent of failed or diminished searches, failed searches being those that could not be filled at all, largely because salaries were not competitive, or those that were diminished because the candidate pool had to be dipped into to the second, third, or fourth candidate. And over the past several years, about a third of the searches have been failed or diminished searches. In the most recent year, our best data indicate about 28%, but even that tends to understate a bit because there are a lot of candidates who never become applicants, people who make inquiries and decide it's not worth bothering at the kind of salaries that we're offering. And so it's a very conservative estimate, and even there, if you're looking at almost a third of your pool being failure or a diminished search, that's really significant. We also look at the at turnover rates, the distribution by age of faculty who leave employment in OUS. And although our turnover rates have been pretty stable over the past 10 or 12 years at about 5% per year, the composition of those who are leaving has changed. And what we're seeing is, rather than in the past where you had naturally older faculty leaving mostly for retirement, increasingly that age has gotten younger. And so over the past 10 years, it's dropped from an average of about 52 years old to about 48 years old. And that may not seem like a lot, but when you think about what it takes to move that down, that is significant. We're seeing more associate rank professors leaving as they're at the peak of their careers and that sort of thing. So that's a piece of data that's important for our campuses to monitor as well, is who's leaving, not just what the turnover rates are. Again, student-faculty ratios are also a reflection of the consequence of being unable to successfully compete for faculty, and so as a result, we haven't been able to fill, even when there have been opportunities with some budget to fill positions, have not been able to, and so in order to meet enrollment demand and course demand, have had to fill those with part-time adjunct faculty, and so that's affected the student-faculty ratios.
Thank you. You know, colleagues, this is, I would like to continue talking about this tomorrow, because this is such a critical issue, and I promised that I would finish. I've got some members who have to go. So, Representative Barnett, really quickly.
I have a question for tomorrow.
Okay.
What would it cost to get our faculty salaries within the, into the mid-range among the peers of our various campuses? And that's not the answer today. Tomorrow.
I understand. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I believe we have some analysis of that.
Thank you,
Representative Barnhart. Representative Johnson?
I just have a question that I don't see any measurement of here as I quickly read through this. But do you have any kind of indication of highly qualified faculty who don't even bother, or highly qualified candidates who do not ever bother to file an application with the Oregon University system? The numbers you give, I think, are related to those who actually submit something. Do we have any kind of indication of those who don't do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I wish we did. We do not. It's kind of an ephemeral figure, as you can appreciate. But certainly, anecdotally, we do have evidence from department chairs and others who are running these searches that they get inquiries and good candidates don't apply.
Thank you very much, Ms. Weeks. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 5515, and we are adjourned. Thank you.